Many, many healthcare organizations have heeded the call of patient safety and are transforming daily practice to reduce and eliminate all measure of harm. The flip side, however, is what happens when bad things do occur. Is there the same kind of intensity and purpose to how your organization responds to patients, family members, staff, and anyone affected? Is there a plan? Is everyone familiar with it? Our focus on today's WIHI is effective crisis management, and we've got three people on tap who have ideas, innovations, models in the making across systems and states, and much more. I'm Madge Kaplan, IHI's Director of Communications and host and producer of WIHI. Jim Conway's with me today, and he told me out in the Southwest they call it Y-Hi. So I don't know if we need a lasso to go along with that, but we'll figure that out. If you're a regular listener participant, welcome back. If you're new to the program, WIHI is IHI's free online audio program that pushes the envelope with improvement in patient care by learning from the best and thinking aloud together. All right, we're so excited. Many of you are still onboarding. We had actually close to 1,200 enroll. We hope we can kind of get half of you here. We know things come up, but please welcome. It's WIHI. I'm Madge Kaplan. You're here. You got here. Thanks for those of you who listened to the music at the top and enjoyed some of the photos. All right, I'm going to first introduce my guests. Now, if you've been following where some of the most proactive approaches are underway with patients and families and staff when things go wrong, you're probably familiar with the University of Michigan Health System and its Chief Risk Officer, Rick Boothman. The work that Rick has been spearheaded is being highly publicized, and it seems more relevant than ever in current discussions about healthcare reform. And it's my pleasure to welcome you, Rick, to WIHI. You there?
Yes.
Good. Okay, that's good. Glad you're here, and we've got your picture and bio here. That information about Rick is also available on our website. Not too far from Michigan in Illinois, if I've got geography right, Dr. Timothy McDonald is the Chief Safety and Risk Officer for Health Affairs at the University of Illinois. We have Tim to thank for policies that have been in place since 2005 at the University of Illinois Chicago Medical Center, and we're talking about a comprehensive program for responding to adverse patient events that includes a detailed crisis management plan and, quote, full disclosure with rapid apology and rapid remedy. That's an interesting, important process. Welcome, Tim. Do we hear you?
I certainly hope so.
I so hope so, too. Thanks so much for being with us. And joining me in the studio is IHI's Senior Fellow, Jim Conway, up until quite recently, and IHI's Senior Vice President. Jim connects me with virtually everyone I need to know, and that is there's no exception with today's WIHI. Jim is known globally for his work on leadership and patient safety. He single-handedly has filled some pages on IHI.org recently with new resources and thinking on effective crisis management. Welcome, Jim.
Welcome, Madge, to you. Age has its privileges.
So, again, more information about all our speakers on IHI.org. And if you are logged in, there's a nice photo of Jim Conway as well. All right. So, Lauren did say that we do sort of hold off on real robust Q&A and questions and comments until about 20 minutes in. But sometimes, if you're a familiar WIHI or you know, I do like to do a pop quiz at the top. This just helps us get the lay of the land. It also it just kind of gives a little environmental scan and also a reminder that your experiences, all of you who've joined today, matter a great deal. So I'd like you, for those of you who are logged in, and if you're only on the phone, not to worry. I will give you the results here. This is a toggle that people can use on the chat feature. I'd like you to use your raised hand toggle, and I want to ask you how and basically use it if you want to answer in the affirmative. How many of you are with organizations that have what you would consider policies and practices to deal effectively and openly with just about everyone affected by an unwanted and unexpected medical event? If that's you, go ahead and put your hand up. All right, we might be leveling out here at about 115 out of about almost 500 of you who are, many of you are still joining. All right, Thank you very much. So 120 of you say you actually are with organizations. Well, we invite you to share kind of what's going on in your organizations that leads you to say that. So that's encouraging. Now, for those of you who could not put your hand up, and by not, I mean because, in fact, you don't think your organization does have such a program, but you'd like it to, I'd like you to just chat in very briefly. What do you think are the reasons why things have not gotten off the ground in your own organization? That'll be nice information for our guests. So just go ahead and chat in. What do you think? I'm going to look here and see. Esther, you're brave. Staff shortages. Okay. Thank you, Esther, for that comment. Fear of bad press. That's what Justin thinks. Go ahead. We'll get underway, but keep typing in. Please chat to all participants. A reminder from Lauren as well. All right, feel free. Just for another minute, other priorities in the hospital in Latin America, no time, lack of buy-in from administration. Sorry, I got to give you guys more time to warm up to your keyboard. Lack of consistency. That's interesting. All right. Okay, we'll keep that open for about another minute, and we'll sort of that way we'll have some of this down, like testimony, I guess, so when you log off today. This will be written into the chat record, and others can benefit from it. All right, I'm going to just go around the horn just to remind everybody who's with us. I'm going to start with Jim. Quick headline, your reaction. You saw about 120 of maybe close to, I don't know, we're upwards over 520 on board with us today. A good number, or kind of your headline right now?
Well, I actually felt, Madge, good about the number, because sometimes when I meet with executives or communications professionals, they say to me, every hospital has one of those things. This isn't a problem. Yet when I go to any audience and ask them to raise your hand, if you have one, very few hands go up. So I'm a big fan of confronting the reality of practice, and I'm pleased at the reality that's coming through in these numbers, because then we can do something with it.
Okay, very, very good. Managers enjoy the cowboy command image of saving the day, being decisive rather than planning ahead. That's very, very interesting. All right, two quick comments. Rick, first to you, and then Tim McDonald, your reaction to the little instant poll there.
I have a couple of responses or reactions. One is, if you're really good at this, you probably have more problem than you think. Responding to crises, nobody is that practiced at it. And the second response is that I think back to the quote, I believe it was from George Patton, who said that the best battle plans become obsolete with the first shot. The truth is, careful planning can probably capture 75% of the needs in the worst case, and you're making it up as you go in about 20 to 25% of the need in those cases. But that 75% is absolutely critical, and the planning is crucial to all of this. I am surprised. I should say I'm not surprised that almost three quarters of our call-in or our participants don't think that they have a comprehensive plan for handling crises.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much, Rick. And Tim McDonald over there in Illinois.
Yeah, my response is similar to what Rick said, from the standpoint of there are a whole lot of people, it appears, who are sort of on the call on the webinar who don't have a plan and are interested in kind of learning about what they might be able to do. And in addition to that, it would be interesting to share, you know, some of the ideas with those who do have a plan, how robust it is and has it been, you know, tested over time. So
okay.
It's an interesting mix. The other thing, I am kind of encouraged to see that you had over 100 who do have a plan, because it seems to me that's a lot of progress.
All right.
Then perhaps maybe where things were, say, 5 years ago. So I actually take that as pretty positive.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, when we open up the chat again, that'll be interesting, particularly for those of you who feel that you're on your way with some kind of a process and plan. Our guests today and all of us would benefit from knowing what do you think is working well. So feel free just to comment that in, in just a few minutes. All right, Jim Conway, I'm going to come back to you. And if you're just joining us, we got 550 of you on, so we're at our kind of halfway mark of our enrollees ahead of time. This is WIHI. I'm Madge Kaplan. Jim Conway, Rick Boothman, and Tim McDonald are with me. We're talking about effective crisis management. So, Jim, a few weeks ago on WIHI, we focused on second victims, and by that we mean any and all staff who are in need of support due to direct or indirect involvement in an adverse or tragic event. Now, this is just one part of a much bigger picture. So I want to ask you, I promised you I would do this, to kind of help us see what is the bigger picture that we're trying to wrap our arms around right now, and why does it matter?
Thanks, Madge. Let me start with a sobering statistic. Every day in this country, hundreds of patients are seriously harmed or die from preventable injury in our hospitals. In the midst of that extraordinary tragedy, we see stories of great courage, learning, and healing going on. But we also experience far too many patients, family members, staff, and institutions that are struggling often for years with disrespectful and inadequate response. You know, I've been privileged to work in healthcare organizations for over 40 years. Healthcare organizations are very large and complex places with extraordinary people and very faulty systems. There is absolutely no question that these clinical events are going to happen in your organization. It's just a matter of time. And frankly, how you handle these events can distinguish your organization from the long term. A very blunt expression I say is the fact that you killed somebody doesn't differentiate you from any other hospital. What differentiates you is the way you respond to that death once it occurs. Let me just give a little bit more context. IHI is often contacted by organizations in the aftermath of tragedy. It's very striking when they make these terrible calls that they have no crisis plan or other advanced planning. They're largely approaching this with a blank piece of paper. They're making it up as they go along, and they're devastated, under the gun, and often paralyzed. And the final context I'll make is what we've learned in this space. When these events happen, there are three priorities that have to be focused on in this order. The first is the patient and family, and we're going to talk about that a lot in the call with my distinguished colleagues. The frontline staff, that spectacular discussion we had a few weeks ago around the second victim. And the third is the institution. So that sets up why we're in this space.
Okay. That's Jim Conway. And as I mentioned at the outset of the call, Jim has been trying to put together the pieces of what really goes into effective crisis management. And through his efforts, we now have some interesting materials on our website that we think can really begin to kind of give people a logical way to think about what goes into it. As those of you who've joined our program before know, we put all these resources together just to remind you of the links in a resource document that will be available by tomorrow. That goes with the archive of today's call, but that's available right now on IHI.org. Okay, thanks, Jim. So this past December, Rick Boothman and Tim McDonald were among those. They taught this amazing mini course at IHI's Forum, and it was entitled Extreme Honesty, a Principled Approach to Adverse Events, and the room was packed. The atmosphere was electric, frankly. clinically, and that, again, was an encouraging sign. A lot of people were there because they wanted to benefit from their expertise. That PowerPoint handout, by the way, from that full-day session is another one of the resources that we're highlighting for you on our document in the archive. So I'm going to start with you, Rick. There's so much going on. You are in so many different I'm reading about you and the work at University of Michigan all the time, and I know this is just a brief snapshot today, but tell us what's going on at the University of Michigan Health System, how long it's been going on, and how well it's working.
I assume you're referring to the effort to respond to patient injury with honesty.
Yes.
I suppose in a nutshell, the best way to put it is that we, in 2001, coalesced what had been years. I mean, I certainly didn't bring ethics to the University of Michigan, but we coalesced what had been an accumulation of years of experience and in these situations into three principles. One is that every patient is owed honesty about the events that they were involved in. And if we hurt someone through unreasonable medical care, then it was the principle of our organization to step up and do the best we could to make it right in a very transparent and honest way. And I have an ulterior motive to that, so put a little asterisk next to that one.
Okay.
The second one is just as important, and that is if our staff, because medical personnel operate in an inherently risky environment with inherently dangerous modalities, drugs, for instance, are unpredictable sometimes, that bad results don't necessarily mean that we did something wrong, and it is equally a compelling responsibility to support our staff, who we've asked to do a lot of difficult things under difficult situations. And if we didn't make a mistake or did not commit a medical error, we would support our staff vigorously. And thirdly, and perhaps most important of the three, we would learn from our patients' mistakes. Patients' experiences, and especially our mistakes. The asterisk that I wanted to highlight in the first principle is this. Not only is it unquestionably every patient's right, in my opinion, to know what happened to them and to expect an apology or an honesty, not just this isn't I'm sorry doesn't work in every situation, but it is every patient's right to expect honesty when bad things, unexpected outcomes have happened to them. The asterisk is because there's a bigger agenda here. We cannot improve unless we acknowledge that we have a problem. Mm-hmm. And the defend and deny environment only propagates a culture of medical error and continues the spiral that the Institute of Medicine has pointed out after 5 years since after the To Err Is Human came out. They pointed out that nothing had changed. I believe that the defend and deny culture, the cost of that is that it completely chills any attempt to improve. And the very best risk management, the very best way to support these courageous caregivers in these difficult situations is to make sure that these mistakes never happen again. So There is an ulterior motive or a larger landscape to that first principle, and that is until we get comfortable acknowledging when we've made errors, we will never make an improvement. Everything that we've done since has sprung from those three principles. And it is amazing how comfortable we got and how quickly we got comfortable with those ideas once we got our arms around our staff, and once we realized that it was not a punitive environment. It was. I don't like the term blameless because it implies that there's no accountability. Uh-huh. We strive to be accountable but not punitive in these situations. And once we got over the fear, because it is the fear that's the impediment, the patient safety focus grew much larger than the fear of claims and litigation. We realized that the sky did not fall in when we became honest. We realized that we lit a fire under everyone here, and the culture has palpably changed in the last 8 years.
really interesting, and I thank you for trying to kind of give us a nut graph of what's been going on. It'll be very interesting to hear from those of you who've joined, and when we open things up for question and comments, to what degree your own experience, where you feel like you do have some good programs in place at your own institutions, resonate with what Rick has said here. I have a follow-up question, but I think what I'd like to do is just get Tim in here. Tim McDonald over there at the University of Illinois. So kind of maybe you can just sort of tee off what Rick has said here in terms of what is going on in your space. And I know you also felt very strongly that we've got to be make some interesting or important distinctions around the apology issue and that this is much more complex or much bigger than saying you're sorry. Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, and I think as a follow up to Rick, and certainly a compliment for him, as many people who've kind of followed our journey, it was in 2005 that we got the okay from our board of trustees to pursue a more principled approach when harm occurs, and they demanded that we create a full comprehensive sort of crisis management approach to it. And fortunately for us, that meant the ability to go to the University of Michigan and have our risk managers connect with Rick, and Rick and I connected to where, in large part, a lot of what we now do at the University of Illinois is sort of a proof of concept of the Michigan approach, where we tried to put into place a lot of the things that Rick had discovered were useful and helpful at Michigan. And like you mentioned, we learned very early on from both our caregivers as well as our patients that the real key to us is a rapid response when harm occurs, independent of whether or not you've made a mistake. Too many places wait until they've got their autopsy back, they've done their root cause analysis, they figure out they made mistakes, and then they're approaching the family sometimes several days or even months later after a lot of distrust has then occurred. And so for us, the key is that immediate and effective communication that hopefully can happen within 15 to 30 minutes of serious harm. And that to us is the key to our crisis management. You know, and that's why we say that this is not a Sorry Works program. It's not about necessarily the apology, although there will be some times when an apology is appropriate. It's really a matter of responding quickly to provide support for caregivers, patients, and families, and provide that sort of ongoing effective communication as you begin to get more and more information when you do that. So that's kind of getting mad at what mm-hmm. it is that you'd asked about.
Do you think the Sorry Works effort is helpful in this environment, is reinforcing, or does it sort of pull people maybe into a more problematic framework?
Well, I think that to one extent, and I know Jim and Rick may comment on this too, but I think to some extent it's useful in that it's created awareness around the fact that we haven't been apologizing when we should have. But I think one of the things that we risk is that some people will take the whole concept of Sorry Works in a way where it almost trivializes how complicated this whole thing can be,
mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't address the caregiver issues. It doesn't address a lot of the other fears, you know, that people have that go into it. And at the end of the day, as Rick has said and other people have said, you know, we shouldn't expect a pat on the back just because we apologize to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
We've still hurt their family member, and we need to be prepared to be held accountable for that.
Okay.
So
okay.
I think you have to be cautious.
Madge, can I
go ahead, Rick? Rick Boothman, and that was just Tim McDonald. Go ahead, Rick.
One of the problems that I have with the concept of Sorry Works is this: in this hospital, every day, sad stories occur. The human drama is overwhelming, and people have bad things happen to good people all the time, and we naturally gravitate, I think, to the compelling human tragedy. But we forget about all the people often who have also been involved in that, who have dedicated their lives to helping patients. And when things go badly, we rightfully and naturally gravitate toward the tragedy and the people who are living that tragedy. But it's important to never forget everybody else. And I think it's too easy to talk about Sari Works as almost a gimmick or just a strategy for saving money, when in fact it's much more organic than that. And as Tim points out, the complexity, both factually, medically, and emotionally, of these incidents are is staggering sometimes, which only highlights the importance, and I agree totally with Tim, of getting on top of these things early, pledging to be honest, but allowing time to be to start processing information and not jumping to conclusions.
Okay.
That's critical.
All right. Thanks, Rick. Jim Conway, again, this is WIHI. I'm Madge Kaplan. You were just hearing Rick Boothman. Before him, Tim McDonald, and here's Jim Conway. Go ahead, Jim.
Madge, I want to just put an extra point, a star, on the comments that Tim and Rick have both made a few years ago. And within the IHI Impact community, we were learning that organizations were getting it right in the area of disclosure, but they were losing the case because they were forgetting to provide ongoing support, bringing the case to resolution, have organizational learning, and then improvement. Because an important part of this conversation is this thing called repentance. And what is very striking in both of these works is a system of processes have been put in place to try to ensure reliably in every case that this whole loop of support, resolution, learning, improvement goes on over and over again.
Okay, good point. I want to go back to, we're going to open things up for questions and comments really in just a couple of minutes. I want to go back to Rick Boothman at the University of Michigan. Can you tell us, how do you measure the effectiveness of what you're doing? What is it that you're measuring? Are you looking at quantitative, qualitative things? And I think that would be interesting for everyone to learn more about.
Well, I wish you hadn't asked me that, because
okay.
One of the,
see, it's unrehearsed, everybody. We can promise you that now.
One of the problems that I've had is that I came here from private practice, not from an academic environment.
Uh-huh.
And after about 3 or 4 years, the academics started approaching me and said, "You mean you didn't put metrics in place?" And I was naive enough to think that metrics were funny wrenches, not measures.
Okay.
the challenges of measuring success,
yep,
are both easy and hard. Our claims started to drop immediately. The needless litigation, the cases that were baseless or groundless, almost fell away right away. And when we look at the cases that started to drop away, the concentration of valid cases went up. We even had someone on our claims committee be depressed because it felt like every case was indefensible that was coming before that committee. And I said that's a good thing, because we were obviously doing a good job of communicating on the others that were going away. So there's all sorts of small measures and large measures. There's anecdotal measures. The ones we have a hard time with is the general sense, I shouldn't say a hard time, but they've taken a while, is the general aura or sense that we live in a place where patient safety is at the top of our culture. And we have now done, I want to say, 4 institutional patient culture surveys, and those are coming up every single time, mm-hmm, which is an awfully good measure. We are measuring some patient safety indicators that a lot of places measure, and those are also improving. So We look at the macro measurements of things like institutional culture. We look at micro measurements of departmental risk and injury experiences. We even look at incidental measures like what has happened with our incident reports.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, only 4 years ago, we had 2,400 incident reports reported to the Department of Risk Management in 1 year. Last year, we had 18,000.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that we're less safe. It means
that
the institution now believes that there's value in doing that because something will happen. And I'm so proud of those measures.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
Malpractice claims are a blunt instrument to measure patient safety because there's so many other things that go into that. They're not irrelevant, but that's not the focus. The focus is patient safety.
Okay. I'm going to let Tim, if you want to jump in with any of this, and then I am going to open things up for chat, and maybe Jim also wants to say something quickly. Tim?
Yeah, in addition to the kinds of stuff that Rick's looking at, and I know he looks at this too, the other thing that we track is, which we consider something that's very bad, is when the first time we hear about harm that befalls a patient is when we get a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
And we have seen those numbers go pretty much to zero, which lets us know at least we're getting more reports and we're also getting more timely reports, so we know about them long before a patient feels like the need to file a lawsuit. But in addition to that, we have taken a lot of this part and really built it into education for our medical students, our nursing students, and as well as our residents. And we just finished an educational intervention with our resident physicians. And one of the metrics that we looked at were the change in attitudes of those residents before the deep dive intervention and then a year after, showing that all of the metrics improved related to the feeling that it was a just place, that it was safe to report, that there wouldn't be the shame and blame. And we also saw a massive increase in the number of occurrence reports from resident physicians, which we never, ever had before.
Because
our goal is, as people have heard us say, is to educate the young and regulate the old. And, and as we get these residents who become our junior faculty, how do we make sure that they're prepared for this kind of comprehensive way of responding to and learning from harmful events?
Very, very interesting. All right. I want to ask Jim just very quickly, you know, in many ways, I think this call is emblematic of the expertise needed or that really matters and helps in designing these kinds of programs. So, Jim, who thinks a lot about leadership and accountability and kind of bottom up and top down, who needs to be driving these kinds of systems? You need a Tim and a Rick at your institution to design this kind of a program.
Well, Madge, my favorite definition of organizational culture is culture is what gets rewarded around here.
Mm-hmm.
So this first has to come from governance, the Board of Trustees, and executive leadership saying this isn't an if discussion, it's a when and how. We are going there. And then it's who we invite in the room. It's the senior leadership who comes to bed together with experts in quality and safety, and we can get in later in the call and approaching what the elements of the plan are. But this is hard stuff. As an leader who has dealt with everything from terrible chemotherapy overdoses to identity theft to other issues in an organization, this is unbelievably hard work, but it has to be grounded in the notion that never worry alone.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I learned as a leader when I was presented with an extraordinary problem, every time I brought together around the table a team of clinicians and administrators, counsel, communication professionals, and every time the outcome was a better outcome than I ever could have imagined when I got that phone call on 3 o'clock in a Friday afternoon and said, oh my.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, with that, thank you, Jim. This is WIHI. I'm Madge Kaplan, and we're having what we hope you agree is a very important discussion about effective crisis management with Jim Conway, Rick Boothman, and Tim McDonald. Now we're going to open things lines up for your questions and comments. We hope you have them at the ready, or we'll kind of join in. All right, so Maggie got in here quickly. What suggestions do you have as to how to address financial compensation due to harm and error? So the financial pieces and compensation, I know that's a part of the University of Michigan. Rick, do you want to take that?
Yes, I'd be happy to. In some ways, the financial compensation calculation is still governed, even though we are rarely in litigation anymore, is still governed by the outline of what is compensable in a courtroom. I say in some ways, but it's not entirely. So that's kind of a starting place. We work hard here to figure out what is the differential between what the result might have been had we not made an error versus what the result was, and then how to price that out. It is, by definition, arbitrary in many cases. So, for instance, in the death of a 9-year-old child, we didn't even try to put a value on her life, and we told the mom that. We said to her, we won't insult you because no amount of money would be enough. So the measure in that case was quite different. We looked at all of her, we tried to put ourselves in her place, and we looked at her needs, we looked at her other surviving children's needs, and we approached it from that perspective. I think the first thing you have to do is know what elements of your team you need, because we have quite an elaborate team or resources available. So I have a PhD medical economist who works in Connecticut, and I use him all the time. We have a financial planner. We have life care planners available when the case requires. So the every case is tailored differently. We work hard to the quality of the discussion is not what could we get hit for in a courtroom, but the quality of the discussion is what do we owe based on what harm we did. And it's very interesting now. I'm almost afraid to look at the statistics. I have not measured this, but my sense is, over the last several years, the comparison between our opening offer in cases in which we've moved for compensation, the comparison between our opening offer and where the case ultimately resolved is very close, because we don't play the games that are played typically in litigation.
Okay. Okay, that's good. Thank you. I don't mean to cut you off, but I think that that's very, very helpful. Other questions that are coming in, people have asked, somebody is asking about support for staff. I think all of these plans have staff in mind. I also invite people to check out our WIHI on the archive page from really just a few weeks ago, where we called it, I think it was SOS from clinicians. I titled it, but I can't quite remember, but it was basically talking about second victims, and that's on the WIHI. Jim.
Madge, I just wanted to respond to the question, what do we think about public disclosure? Yes. Obviously, respecting the patient and family, you know, on the IHI website is the story of Emmanuel St. Joseph, where they had a staff member diverting drugs from patients and families. And within hours of discovery, the CEO of that institution, Dr. Kucher, went before the community to apologize for failing to fulfill their responsibilities for them. He told me after the fact that their relationship both with the community and their own staff is stronger as a result of the openness and the transparency that they saw coming out of this event. The other point I want to make to that I was giving a talk in Hawaii, and after the talk, somebody had to go. I went, and after the talk, a nurse exec came up to me, and she was very emotional, and she said, "Jim, we just killed a patient. Everybody's talking about it, but the institution." Mm-hmm. And we really, I learned that he or she who informs the first story informs the overall story, and we in our work are seeing organizations that are coming out stronger as a result of public disclosure.
Okay, very, very important. Jim Conway there. This is WIHI. I'm Madge Kaplan, and Tim McDonald and Rick Boothman are with me as well. We have a question that I think I'm going to throw to you, Tim, which really has to do, somebody is saying that he's struck, I think it's he's struck by the suggestion of providing a meaningful response within 15 to 30 minutes. Who does that? This person is asking, and can you just give an example of what that actually might look like?
Well, yeah, Madge. What we set up is a hotline that is available and well-known to all staff, where when they call it, they will get one of our people who are trained in effective communication to provide these people with sort of just-in-time training for how to have those initial conversations. If they're in the hospital when it happens, they may come up and help them, you know, begin the investigation and do all that, but also give advice on the best early response to what it is that's occurred. That's, you know, sort of done on a case-by-case basis. This has really been an effort to let the institution know that we are here to support them when this kind of when a crisis occurs, and they know how to get us and get us right away to be able to support them. So that's how we set that up.
Okay. There had been a question also earlier about whether or not certain specially trained people are needed. Are you pulling from your kind of existing staff and sort of positions people are familiar with, or is there a sort of some specially created positions for this process? I think Susan Scott was asking, is there almost like an ombudsperson? Can you address that?
Yeah, well, we learned a lot of this again from Rick in Michigan. We took our pre-existing staff and trained those who are particularly interested to become part of sort of this SWAT team.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't created any more positions to sort of do this. It's already contained within our Department of Safety and Risk Management. And then there's other people who have stepped up, nurses and docs who said, hey, they'd like to be part of this rapid response process, and they find a lot of value to it, to them professionally, to be part of that.
Okay, thanks. Another question, if you're getting started, you're having meeting one about creating an institutional system and response, Jim, who's at the table for those early discussions, or the first one even?
Madge, I think this is a responsibility that starts with the C-suite. It starts with the CEO and the senior leadership. It would not at all be unusual to have a trustee involved because of the essential link to governance. Clearly, you want counsel in the room. You want communications. You need your professionals in the area of quality, safety, and risk, patient relations, and the culture that I enjoyed for 10 years. It would always include a patient or a family member. But it's this notion of coming together to begin to have the discussion. And you need a Mikey. You need a devil's advocate, because you don't want to get there's somebody who has to be really pushing you around this. And then you begin going through the various tools or approaches you need to develop, and let me just sort of give you the little buckets. You need to know, how do we think about this before the event happens? What would be in a plan? We begin that discussion, and I'm thrilled to say that IHI is about 2 months away from making available a tool, which will be on the website that anybody could go to, and you could use it for two reasons. One, it would help this group write the plan. It basically says, what are the key elements of the plan? What do you have to do when? And it not only lists the elements, but it says, what do you do in the first half hour? There are specific things you should do in the first half hour, as we've already heard, in the first day, in the first week, in the first month, and on an ongoing basis. The reason we're delaying it to 2 months is we're taking this content through a couple of work groups and web and actions, really to make sure that we are nailing this to the 70% that's already been mentioned. So this is a organizational activity. It's not just for the chosen one or two. This is a very important organizational effort. And then it's really guided by all of the things that we've already put out on the website, given by courageous organizations, as well as this tool, which is a couple of months away unless you're part of the work group.
Okay, very good. Well, stand by for that, and we will make sure people can sort of figure out how to be ready for that. Somebody has asked about training resources for disclosure communications. I think those are starting to come along out of different academic medical centers, et cetera. I don't want to get too bogged down on suddenly talking about website links and that kind of thing. But Tim or Rick, did you folks kind of either take advantage or develop something that you felt were kind of good sorts of training resources, particularly related to disclosure?
I actually want to make a distinction first.
Go ahead, Rick.
Our risk managers are available 24/7, as is the chief of staff and his office. We trained every risk manager in mediation techniques, and they went through intensive training. I want to say it's 50 hours or more. With role plays and that sort of thing. The training was actually designed for legal settings, but we use them across the board in all sorts of interpersonal settings. We do not train our physicians because, first, these events are remote. Most physicians are not doing so-called disclosure every day. We train our physicians in the values of setting reasonable expectations and seeing informed consent as something other than a legal hurdle. Mm-hmm. But we do not want, and we actually discourage physicians who are involved in these very complex emotional events to try and do disclosure by themselves. I happen to think it's irresponsible to put on a seminar and then expect your medical staff to handle these things unsupported when they happen, because the most socially mature people are so complex, struggling with such complex emotions at the time it happens, that I don't want them to do that. We want them to call for help and let someone else at least shepherd them through it. That doesn't mean that risk management is the face of the disclosure. Often we'll help a doctor through that process, mm-hmm. but never in the heat of the moment.
Okay.
That being said, there are some good people. Tom Gallagher, for instance, does a beautiful job at the University of Washington, and he and Tim and I are both training folks all the time in this process.
Okay, Tom Gallagher at the University of Washington. We'll follow up on that and get that into the resource document. Go ahead, Jim.
Madge, just a quick comment on the Effective Crisis Management webpage, which you'll have a link on. There's just a tremendous amount of resources on disclosure, toolkits, videos. One of the things that we're very excited about is we'll be pointing you to some resources that are very established, developed by the Harvard's Risk Management Foundation, that are going to be available also to people who are participating on this call. But tons of content out there on the website to help people in that area.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. Go ahead, Tim.
Uh-huh. To follow up on what Rick said, yep. and fully agreeing with him, which is why we have our support staff available, we do training for the residents and for the faculty to show them how hard it is.
Yeah.
And we actually use standardized patients.
Somebody asked about that, so that's good.
And what we do, though, with the standardized patients is we take real scenarios, and I know Rick's familiar with many of these, where the patient breaks bad, and with a doc that's trying to do the disclosure, and invariably, since they've not practiced it very much, it doesn't often go very well. And so we use these seminars and these scenarios to teach the docs the limits of their abilities to deal with these, particularly in a crisis situation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's led them to understand how complicated it is. and that they are very thankful when they've been through it that the institution has an infrastructure
right.
to support them when it really does happen.
Very, very interesting. Jim, thanks, Tim. Jim mentioned a reference to some films and CRICO Risk Management Fund, and I do want to say they have some films. One is called When Things Go Wrong, Voices of Patients and Families, and a forthcoming one this spring is called Healing the Healer, and that is focusing on clinicians, produced and distributed by CRICO RMF Risk Management Fund. And on our resource page, we're going to have a link to that, and I want to thank CRICO RMF for giving WIHI participants a discount on some of ordering some of those films, so you can take advantage of that. And also do want to mention that IHI on March 31st has a web in action coming up, three sessions on effective crisis management dealing with serious clinical events. It will draw upon a lot of the types of things we're talking about today, and the program features an all-star list of expert executive people who are experts in the executive front, communications, and improvement faculty. So we do hope you'll perhaps check that out, and more information on IHI.org. I have a question for maybe for Rick and Tim both. One of the things, as this issue gets covered quite a bit in varying ways in the press, and of course, you know, there's the context of malpractice reform, which is one way often the press gets interested in these things, finding alternatives to malpractice and expensive lawsuits. But what about the need for state laws that in some way or another sort of offer protection, either to physicians or institutions? To what extent is that a necessary part of this work going forward? I think over, 23, many states now have varying kinds of laws on the books that are designed to offer some protection in the hope of more disclosure, I guess. But could maybe I get both of you to comment on that? Let me start with you, Tim.
Well, I mean, and I know how Rick
another
knows
show
how I feel about this. Well, no, I mean, the issue is if you're committed to being, effective communicators and honest with your patients and families, then you don't need legislative protection for that. You're going to come out, and if you've provided inappropriate care, you're going to apologize for it, and you're going to make it right. And so to some extent, one of my big fears, and we've actually thought about this here in Illinois, and as it turns out, our apology laws were just tossed out when our entire tort reform from 2005 was overturned by our Supreme Court. But our notion is we would like the apology actually to get into court if we needed it to be there. In other words, some of these laws are written that the apology can never come in for any reason.
Mm-hmm.
And we would actually like the jury to hear the fact that we showed empathy and we apologized if, in fact, we did.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I'll let Rick comment on that because I know he has pretty strong feelings about that sort of stuff.
All right, strong feelings. You're up.
You can tell he's been bludgeoned by having to listen to me.
Okay.
Honesty is not honesty if it is only uttered behind closed doors. So you're either committed to honesty or you're not. Now, that being said, I fully understand, especially after being 22 years in the trenches representing doctors and hospitals, I understand how daunting it can be. And if apology laws help physicians feel more comfortable, then they're fine. Most of them are not really worth the paper they're written on because they say an expression of empathy is not admissible as an admission, but a true admission of guilt is admissible. And, you know, as a practicing lawyer, I know that that really isn't very helpful. We have no statutory protections in Michigan. We do not get non-disclosure agreements before we're willing to talk to someone. And I tell patients all the time, whatever we're saying here, I would say in public. That just, it does raise the stakes to make sure that you know what you're talking about when you start those discussions. And as Tim often points out, it's always a process, not a single conversation.
Okay. All right. Very, very good. All right. Well, we're kind of heading to the top of the hour, so I'm going to do kind of a round robin. I'm going to start with Jim Conway here. Sort of parting ideas. Jim already kind of gave you a heads up that he's hard at work on sort of an hour-by-hour sort of work plan that I think is going to present a wonderful scan for people in terms of what do you need to be thinking about and doing. But parting thoughts from you, Jim, and now then I'll turn to Rick and Tim both.
Manj, my parting thoughts, let me give a little bit of specificity about what I think this, that when I talk about a crisis plan, because I want to move this to granular and not just stay up in the clouds, is there's a document that says when you hear that something happens, who's notified, who assembles, how are you handling the first priority to the patient and family, the second one to the staff, the third to the institution? What are your plans for internal and external communications, and how are you handling external notifications and unannounced visits? You have an absolute ability to figure and begin to think about that today before you get that phone call, and in the process serve the patient, the family, the staff, and the community far more effectively and respectfully.
Okay, thank you. Jim Conway. Rick Boothman.
Picking up on what Jim said, this actually can be done methodically and needs to be done not in a crisis but in a quiet moment. You begin, I think, by taking stock on what you as an organization want to stand for. And if you are committed to openness and honesty, then all the players, all the interested parties need to be on the same page. Because if your public relations department issues a message which is inconsistent with what you as an organization want to do with the family, that's not helpful. And the biggest problem is exacerbating the injury that's already happened. By handling things in an uncoordinated way, less than integrated way, you can actually do more damage than good. So it's best to start with a cultural realization and actualization, then put yourself in the position of every interested party to understand what the expectations will be and be on the same page.
Okay. Thank you, Rick Boothman and Tim McDonald.
Yeah, I think one of the important things is once you think you have it ready and wired and ready to go, it doesn't hurt to run a mock event to see whether or not you have all the pieces in place, that your rapid response team fires and is ready, the people that are at the ready to provide care for the caregiver respond and are there as well, and that you're able to get a hold of the people you need to get a hold of in the first 30 minutes or first 24 hours. And so, because as Rick said early on, you may think you have it ready, but until it's tested either in a mock or then certainly once you get the real case that comes in, it's important to look back and reflect on what did we do well and what did we not do well. In fact, we've made our whole response process part of our root cause analysis, where we expect certain elements to occur in each event, and we look and see, did they? And if they didn't, what do we need to do to make sure that that crisis management process gets to run as effectively as possible.
Okay, very, very good. All right, thank you, Tim McDonald, Rick Boothman, and Jim Conway. I really, really appreciate your time today and the amount of time you put in to planning this with me. I want to thank everyone who joined the conversation today. You are participants. You raised good questions. You made good comments. Check out our website where you'll find an audio download of this program by tomorrow. Also, the famous resource document that we were talking about. When you log off today's program, you can also download any of the slides, also the chat, which is often very, very interesting. And again, anyone who you knew wanted to be on the show today, please tell them they can find an audio program also, on our archived part of WIHI web pages and also on iTunes. Any questions whatsoever, info@ihi.org. On the next WIHI, and that's on March 18th, 2010, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, we're going to switch gears just a bit, and we're going to talk about some new thinking from the world of behavioral psychology about fomenting big and small changes in any organization. I think we've been talking about big and small changes today. Chip Heath is the co-author of the new book, Switch: How to Change Things When Change is Hard, and their first book was the bestseller Made to Stick, and Chip is going to be here with Joe McCannon, IHI fellow, former vice president here, and when you're wondering what else can I possibly do or say to move something forward in this organization that seems to be stuck? Bring that wonderment to WIHI on March 18th. We just may have some ways to get out of that logjam. Information about all that is now on our website as I speak. The people who make WIHI possible are Jonathan Small, Mike Sweeney, Jesse McCall, Alan Olison, Brittany McPhee, Jane Roster, Vicki Minden. Lauren Music was with us today on WebEx, and I gratefully appreciate her help. The musical selections that you hear just before WIHI begins are performed and arranged by Patricio and Jennifer Batayas. Aaron Flanders on guitar and Miguel Sapasoa are doing these original arrangements just before the open and close of the program. It's my privilege to host a program that's about spirited learning and improving patient care most of all. It's really an honor. For the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, I'm Madge Kaplan. Good day.